We're going to deal with Exodus chapters 33 and 34 today. And I want to be very clear where Israel stands with God at this moment in Exodus. The Mosaic covenant has been broken. It's not in operation. And therefore, Israel's relationship with God is broken. All the result of idol worship of that golden calf. Now, the result of Israel breaking some of the terms of the Mosaic covenant will not be the end or the abolishment of Israel as God's chosen people, because the Lord reestablished the same covenant with Moses when Moses trekked back up the mountain with a fresh set of stone tablets. And we don't see this explained, by the way, until the book of Deuteronomy. So let's read Exodus chapter 33 together. Exodus chapter 33, we're going to read it all. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we start on page 98. Exodus chapter 33. Adonai said to Moshe, "Leave, you and the people you brought up from the land of Egypt, move on from here towards the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov. I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel ahead of you. I will drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. You will go to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I myself will not go with you, because you are such a stiff-necked people that I might destroy you on the way." Now when the people heard this bad news, they went into mourning, and no one wore his ornaments. And Adonai said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go up with you for even one moment, I would exterminate you. Now, keep your ornaments off. Then I'll decide what to do to you." So from Mount Horeb onward, the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments. Moses would take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far away from the camp. He called it the Tent of Meeting. Everyone who wanted to consult Adonai would go out to the tent of meeting outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would get up and stand, each man at his tent door, and look at Moses until he had gone into the tent. Whenever Moses entered the tent, the column of cloud would descend and station itself at the entrance to the tent, and Adonai would speak with Moshe. When all the people saw the column of cloud stationed at the entrance to the tent, they would get up and prostrate themselves, each man at his tent door. Adonai would speak to Moshe face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Then he would return to the camp. But the young man who was his assistant, Joshua, the son of Nun, never left the inside of the tent. And Moses said to Adonai, "Look, you say to me, 'Make these people move on,' but you haven't let me know whom you'll be sending with me. Nevertheless, you have said, 'I know you by name,' and also you have found favor in my sight. Now please, if it is really the case that I found favor in your sight, show me your ways, so that I will understand you and continue finding favor in your sight. Moreover, keep on seeing this nation as your people." He answered, "Set your mind at rest. My presence will go with you after all." And Moshe replied, "If your presence doesn't go with us, don't make us go on from here. For how else is it to be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people, other than by your going with us? This is what distinguishes us, me and your people, from all the other peoples on earth." And Adonai said to Moses, "I will also do what you have asked me to do, because you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." But Moses said, "I beg you, show me your glory." And he replied, "I will cause all my goodness pass before you, and in your presence I will pronounce the name of Adonai. Moreover, I show favor to whomever I will. I display mercy to whomever I will. But my face," he continued, "you cannot see, because a human cannot look at me and remain alive. Here," he said, "is a place near me. Stand on the rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you inside a crevice in the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I'll remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face is not to be seen." Yehovah, in verse 1, gives Moses orders for Israel to strike camp and to move on. Now, they're still at the base of Mount Sinai. Sometimes it's called Mount Horeb. And they've been there for about a year. The law has been given. The instructions for God's tabernacle has been given. Now it's time to move on towards their goal, the land of promise, Canaan. That's the good news. The bad news is that the punishment for Israel's breaking of the covenant is God will not dwell among them. However, in his great mercy, he will send an angel ahead of Israel that will drive out the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, drive them out ahead of Israel's arrival. Now, God tells the people there to remove their ornaments. That is, they're not to wear any of their jewelry. This signifies a couple of things to the Hebrews. First, jewelry goes hand in hand with joyousness. And that is not called for considering what has transpired. They should be in a state of mourning for losing the presence and covenant of God because of their actions. Second of all, the jewelry was what had been used for making the golden calf. This was not what it was supposed to have been used for. The jewelry was the result of a kind of God-ordained retribution upon the Egyptians when Yehovah instructed Israel to strip Egypt as they were leaving. And the precious metals were in part going to be needed for God's dwelling place. Now in verse 7, we're told that whenever Moses would pitch the tent, he did it outside the camp of Israel. Those are words to remember. Outside the camp. Now let's think about that for a minute, just because there's some interesting aspects here that I'd like to point out to you. First of all, most commentators make this tent out to be the God-ordained tabernacle. And even the word tabernacle, and even though the word tabernacle exists, it doesn't exist in these verses, many translators have decided that this is what it means. So they just turn around and insert the word. Now I have a problem with the notion that the tabernacle even existed at this moment. Now, first of all, the timing doesn't seem to be right. Up to now, all that's been given is instructions on how to build the tabernacle. There's no evidence that the tabernacle has actually been constructed. The golden calf incident has interrupted everything. It won't be until Moses goes back up to the mountain to receive a second set of tablets that the tabernacle is built. And therefore, God has separated himself from Israel because the covenant doesn't actually exist at the moment that makes Israel his covenant people. Now, second, the word used throughout these verses to describe what Moses erected was in Hebrew, oel. Oel means tent. Tent, oel, is used in several places in this chapter, and it is the only word used to refer to whatever it was that Moses erected outside the camp. It is also used when we're told that whenever the Israelites saw Moses heading towards his oel, they would stand outside their own oel, their own tent. Now, third is the indication that it was Moses who actually erected the tent. I mean, we know that it would have taken hundreds and hundreds of people to erect the tabernacle. However, the verse simply doesn't give us any impression that any Levite, other than Moses, perhaps his most immediate family, were even involved in erecting this tent, this oel. And finally, we know from Numbers and Deuteronomy that when the tabernacle was erected, the tribes surrounded it and camped in a very specific order around it that we've already discussed. In that arrangement, the tabernacle is not only inside of the camp, it is the center, right at the center of the camp. It's the focus of the camp. Now, I think that the particular tent used here was some kind of a temporary one. It was probably just an ordinary tent. May even have been Moses' personal tent. Now we're told in verses 9 and 10 that the cloud would station itself at the entrance to the tent. Whereas later, when we know for sure we're speaking of God's ordained model of the heavenly tabernacle, the wilderness tabernacle, the cloud would hover over the tent. So something's different about this tent. We also see that Joshua never left the inside of the tent. That was certainly not the case with the wilderness tabernacle, because then only priests, Levites, could even enter the tabernacle. Joshua was not a Levite, and he was not a mediator. He was from the tribe of Ephraim. In fact, later on we're told that anyone other than priests from Levi would be killed if they had anything to do with the tabernacle. How was Moses allowed in? He was a Levite, and he was also God's appointed mediator. Now, what we're getting a picture of is that when Moses needed to meet with God, he actually did so outside the tent, while Joshua stayed separate from Moses and from God by staying more or less hidden away inside the tent. And a reasonable question is, so how is it that God told Moses up on Mount Sinai that he required the construction of this elaborate and detailed tabernacle for his presence if he was going to dwell with man, but then turned around and met with Moses in front of an ordinary tent? My contention is there was nothing intrinsically holy about the wilderness tabernacle, nor any other created thing. God simply declared it to be holy. The tabernacle was not for the sake of God. It was for the sake of the people. It was so they could be assured visibly of God's presence. And it was so they could be reminded of his law and of his perfect holiness in hope they wouldn't sin. The tabernacle was an important teaching tool, perhaps more for us today than it was even for the Israelites back then. God could decide, you know, to declare the room we're sitting in to be holy. If he did, that's that. Nothing to argue about. I guess God declared that plain old tent he was currently meeting with Moses in to be holy. Now remember, for a time now in Exodus, everything is topsy-turvy as a result of Israel breaking the covenant. Israel has severed their relationship with God, and so God has removed his presence from Israel. The reality is that his presence with them was all that distinguished Israel from anybody else. Now, whereas inside the camp of Israel was supposed to be the clean area, outside the camp, the unclean area, there is no inside the camp that's clean right now. Doesn't exist. The only clean area is that tiny little spot away from where Israel camped that Moses erected that temporary tent and met God. The idea of being inside or outside the camp really only has meaning in the current context, in the sense that the Lord is either in Israel's midst or he's not. And for now, the Lord is not in Israel's midst. So he's not inside the camp. So okay, now, another little conundrum. Verse 11. Verse 11 says, Moses and God spoke face to face as friends. But later in verse 20, God says that no one, including Moses, can see God's face and live. How do we deal with this seeming contradiction? I'm going to go into some depth about this matter because we're going to get this little phrase, face to face, many times in the Torah, and several of those times it is referring to God speaking with Moses. Now, there's a Hebrew word used here that can mean presence or it can mean face. That word is panaim. It can mean a face just like we think of a face, human or animal. Or it can indicate a presence. Now, personally, although not every Bible translator or scholar would agree with me, I think that what we're being told here is that Moses spoke to God face to presence. Remember, that word has two meanings. Face to presence. Moses' face, God's presence. The spiritual presence, of course. That is, God's spirit was present. It was near versus far. Moses' conversation with Jehovah was not like prayer was back then, which allowed man to communicate with God from afar. In other words, man is on earth praying to God who's up in heaven. We're separated. Big barrier between us and him. Moses' face-to-presence communication with God is almost indistinguishable from a believer's modern-day prayer life since the day of Pentecost, when his Holy Spirit came to dwell in humans. Because God's presence is always present with us, we don't speak to him from afar. We speak to him face to face like a friend, because he's near. Believers have a very similar, not exact, but a very similar privilege as to what Moses had. There's also another consideration. Face to face was, in that day, used as a Hebrew expression. And it could mean a couple of things. First of all, it could speak of an intense conversation, almost a heated debate. Or even better, some real hard bargaining. If you've ever been to the Middle East, you've ever even seen a travelogue on TV of an Oriental market, you're going to see people loudly arguing and hands flailing about and scowling and seemingly angry at each other. This is purely cultural. And it's the cultural way they conduct business in negotiation. In reality, anger is in no way being displayed. Jews will do the same thing when discussing Jewish religious doctrines and laws. Now, a second meaning is that indeed one of the parties is displaying anger. It's very difficult to know in the Holy Scriptures whether face-to-face is simply indicating presence or hard bargaining or indeed anger. It's all in the context. It's all in the cultural nuance. However, in verse 20, the general belief among Hebrew scholars is that when God tells Moses that he can't see his face, it's more along the lines of face as we think of a human face than it is in a general presence. So verse 11 is about God's presence. And the same way we think of the Holy Spirit's invisible presence inside of us in our day, verse 20 is about God's face that apparently could be, if he wanted it to be, visible to human eyes. Yet, there is a strong hint that face-to-face in verse 11 also incorporates the idea of a heated debate. Because beginning in verse 12, we get this typical Middle Eastern style interplay between God and Moses. Moses questions, God says what he's going to do. Moses disagrees, offers us an alternative suggestion. God says, no. Moses tries to get God to see it his way. A little compromise, and God eventually agrees. In verse 19, God says he's going to show Moses his goodness. And that he's going to proclaim the name of the Lord before Moses. Now, just so we're on the same page, what actually is said is, in the Hebrew, I will proclaim the name of Yehovah, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Not, I will proclaim the name of the Lord. God is saying he's going to speak his own formal name, which is formed by the Hebrew letters Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I call it Yehovah. A lot of people say it's Yahweh. Now, God is revealing his nature to Moses. In Middle Eastern culture, to reveal one's name is to reveal one's character, because name and character are organically connected. God is too holy even for Moses to look upon his face. God is merciful, God is gracious, but he says he will choose who he's merciful and gracious to. We don't get to decide that. We don't get to declare it. Chapter 33 ends with Yehovah directing Moses to stand in a crevice, a cleft in a rock, and with God himself covering Moses' eyes so that he does not see God's face. But after God passes by, we're told Moses can see God's back. What does that mean? I don't know. I have no earthly idea. Everything I've ever read about this, Jewish or Christian, is very unsatisfactory to me. And it amounts to little more than allegory and opinion. So I'm just going to leave it there. You figure it out. Let's move on to chapter 34. Exodus chapter 34, page 99, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Adonai said to Moshe, cut yourself two tablets of stone like the first ones. I will inscribe on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready by morning. In the morning you are to ascend Mount Sinai and present yourself to me on top of the mountain. No one's to come up with you. No one is to be seen anywhere on the mountain. Don't even let the flocks or the herds feed in front of this mountain. Moses cut two stone tablets like the first, and then he got up early in the morning, and with the two stone tablets in his hand, he ascended Mount Sinai, as Adonai had ordered him to do. Adonai then descended in a cloud. He stood with him there and pronounced the name of Adonai. Adonai passed before him and proclaimed, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah, is God, merciful and compassionate, slow to anger, rich in grace and truth, showing grace to the thousandth generation, forgiving offenses, crimes, and sins, yet not exonerating the guilty, but causing the negative effects of their parents' offenses to be experienced by their children and grandchildren, even by the third and fourth generations. At once Moses bowed his head to the ground and prostrated himself and said, if I have now found favor in your view, Adonai, then please let Adonai go with us, even though they are a stiff-necked people. And please pardon our offenses and our sin and take us as your possession. He said, here, I am making a covenant. In front of all your people, I will do wonders such as not been created anywhere on earth or in any nation. All the people around you will see the work of Adonai. What I'm going to do through you will be awesome. Observe what I'm ordering you to do today. Here, I am driving out ahead of you the Amori, Canaani, Hiti, Perizi, Hivi, and Yavusi. Be careful not to make a covenant with the people living in the land where you're going, so that they won't become a snare within your own borders. Rather, you are to demolish their altars, smash their standing stones, cut down their sacred poles, because you are not to bow down to any other god. Since Adonai, whose very name is jealous, is a jealous God, do not make a covenant with the people living in the land. It will cause you to go astray after their gods and sacrifice to their gods. Then they'll invite you to join them in eating their sacrifices, and you'll take their daughters as wives for your sons. Their daughters will prostitute themselves to their own gods, and they'll make your sons do the same. Do not cast metal gods for yourselves. Keep the festival of matzah, of unleavened bread. By eating matzah, as I ordered you for 7 days during the month of Aviv. For it is in the month of Aviv that you came out from Egypt. Everything that is first from the womb is mine. Of all your livestock, you are to set aside for me the males, the firstborn of cattle and flock. The firstborn of a donkey, you must redeem with a lamb. If you won't redeem it, break its neck. All the firstborn of your sons you are to redeem. No one is to appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you will work, but on the seventh day you are to rest. Even in plowing time and harvest season, you are to rest. Observe the festival of Shavuot with the first gathered produce of the wheat harvest and the festival of ingathering at the turn of the year. 3 times a year, all of your men are to appear before the Lord, Adonai, the God of Israel, for I'm going to expel nations ahead of you, expand your territory. No one will even covet your land when you go up to appear before Adonai, your God, 3 times a year. You are not to offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, and the sacrifice of the feast of Pesach, Passover, is not to be left until morning. You are to bring the best first fruits of your land into the house of Adonai, your God. You are not to boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Adonai said to Moses, write these words down, because they are the terms of the covenant I have made with you and with Israel. Moshe was there with Adonai 40 days and 40 nights, during which time he neither ate food nor drank water. Adonai wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words. When Moshe came down from Mount Sinai with the 2 tablets of the testimony in his hand, he didn't realize the skin of his face was sending out rays of light as a result of his talking with Adonai. When Aaron and the people of Israel saw Moses, the skin on his face was shining and they were afraid to approach him. But Moshe called to them, and then Aharon and all the community leaders came back to him, and Moshe spoke to them. Afterwards, all the people of Israel came near, and he passed on to them all the orders that Adonai had told him on Mount Sinai. And once Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But when he went in before Adonai for him to speak, he would take the veil off until he came out. Then when he came out, he would tell the people of Israel what he had been ordered. But when the people of Israel saw Moses' face, that the skin of Moses' face shone, he would put the veil back over his face until he went in again to speak with Adonai. If chapter 32 was about the breaking of the covenant relationship with God and man, and then chapter 33 showed what happens when the covenant is invalidated, then chapter 34 is about the reinstatement of the covenant of Moses. Or as Everett Fox calls this, the 5th divisions of the 6 divisions of Exodus, infidelity and restoration. Now, Yehovah directs Moses to cut 2 stone tablets and bring them to the summit of Mount Sinai. And since a little time has passed since we've talked about the location of where all this was taking place, this might be a good time to remind you that this mountain of God goes by another name. In addition to Mount Sinai, it's called Mount Horeb. They're one and the same place. I also like you to recall that it is unimaginable that the location of Mount Sinai is actually on the Sinai Peninsula. The traditional location of Mount Sinai, where St. Catherine's Monastery is built and thousands of Christian pilgrims come year after year to imagine Moses and the Ten Commandments, defies both scriptural description and geographical possibilities. Let us remember how this site near the southern end of the Sinai was first declared to be the mountain of God. Anybody ever gone there? Well, I have, more than a couple of times. You see, it was Constantine, Emperor of Rome, in the 4th century. He had become a Christian, And he declared Christianity as a government authorized and therefore a legal religion within the Roman Empire. Now, his mother, Catherine, was also a convert. And so both mother and son were prone to visions. Almost every biblical site in Israel today that has a monastery or a Catholic church built on it, it was ordered by Catherine to commemorate some event or another concerning Christ. Almost universally, these many specific sites bore no known historical reality to the Jews. None. Rather, all these choices that are now so cemented into Christian tradition were the results of Constantine's mother's, Catherine's, dreams and visions. Mount Sinai is one such site. Now, one would think that if the site of the true Mount Sinai was the one chosen by Catherine, that the Jews would have greatly revered it for centuries before she was even around. The Jews know nothing of this location of Mount Sinai of Exodus fame. Now, interestingly, in Galatians 4:25, Paul states that Mount Sinai is actually in Arabia. Josephus also states Mount Sinai is in Arabia, and so does Philo. Let's also remember that before Moses went to Egypt to free the people, when he was still a shepherd in Midian, he was attracted to a bush that was burning on a mountain in Midian. The Bible states unequivocally that it was the same mountain at which Moses first encountered God at the burning bush, that was the same one Israel was to be brought to when they left Egypt. Midian is on the Arabian Peninsula. It's not on the Sinai Peninsula. Some traditionalist Christian scholars have fought this, saying that Sinai was considered part of Arabia at that time. That's just plain inaccurate. There's not a hint of historical proof to that effect. None. In fact, everything against it. Not one piece of evidence has ever been found or documented to indicate this. This is pure fantasy, and it's retained only to keep a highly dubious tradition. But it is well documented that Egypt controlled the Sinai at the time of Moses, and that Midian definitely was on the Arabian Peninsula. A few scholars also tried to explain Paul and Josephus away by stating that this mention of Arabia just must have been allegorical. Of course, allegory is indeed at the heart of why the institutional church has wandered so far off course over the past few centuries, and how it could be that literally thousands of Christian denominations, thousands, have been formed, all basing themselves supposedly on the same common document, the Bible, often holding widely different views. That is, since taking the Bible at its word, taking it literally, usually blew away Western Gentile church doctrines that sought to rid Christianity of anything Jewish, making the scriptures allegorical or metaphorical became the best solution to accomplish that. Up became allegorical for down. Israel became allegorical for church. East became metaphorical for evil. And Western Arabia became allegorical for Sinai. It's nonsense. Many lessons ago, we examined the route of the Exodus in the area where Paul and Josephus say Mount Sinai is located, and we found a place that not only matched the biblical description, but even found solid archaeological evidence of the Israelites' stay there. The place was in Arabia. And by the way, this is nothing to get real upset over. That Mount Sinai was actually in Arabia changes nothing about God's laws and his ways, or about Christ, or about our faith. It's just interesting to know how certain traditions got started, and we can wonder why millions of people would choose to accept myth over truth. Well, anyway, back to the stone tablets. God says he's going to write, or better, rewrite, on these new stone tablets the Ten Commandments in order to replace the tablets that Moses had smashed down upon seeing the people's grievous rebellion against Jehovah when they built that golden calf. Now recall that Moses' shattering of those tablets was Middle Eastern custom for indicating that an agreement, a covenant between two parties had been violated. And therefore the tablet, that the terms of the covenant to be recorded on, were ceremonially, literally broken. Now Jehovah descended in a cloud to where Moses had come. As this shows us once again, whether it is on the mountain or soon in the tabernacle, God's presence was not there at all times. He came and he went. Now at the end of the previous chapter, chapter 33, Moses had asked to see God's glory, and God was willing to grant Moses' request to a degree. The answer to the question of just where Moses would stand and behold God's glory pass by is now answered. It was at the summit of Mount Sinai, the rock whose cleft Moses would hide in while God's visible presence passed by was at the top of the holy mountain. Let's take a look at that for a minute. What is happening in chapter 34, verses 6 and 7, is that Jehovah is proclaiming his character to Moses. Now, today we take this for granted. You know, if we've ever attended a church or a synagogue, we've been taught about God's love and his mercy and so on. But these few verses are so important and so central to the Hebrew religion that they became part of future Jewish synagogue liturgy known as the 13 attributes of God. Jehovah tells Moses that his very essence is mercy, love, patience, faithfulness, that he is loyal to those whom he sets apart. Keeping loyalty to the thousandth generation, as it states in verse 6, that's a Hebrew idiom. It just means forever. Yet God says his justice demands that he cannot call the guilty innocent. In fact, the sins of the fathers will affect their offspring to the third and fourth generations. Even more, God will cause it, we're told. He'll cause it to affect the third and fourth generations. Why will it affect the third and fourth generations? Because in that day of extended families living together from birth to death, the typical family unit consisted of three or four generations. So simply referring to the household, one entire household. You with me on that? In other words, it was typical that grandparents, great-grandparents, parents, and children, they all lived together in one big family unit. So when the sins of the great-grandfather, for instance, were punished, typically it affected the whole family. I mean, if he got a drought, everybody got a drought. Now, in our culture, and in this age of what demographers call the nuclear family, it's only the parents and their immediate children that typically form a household. It's a two-generation family unit. But it works the same way. Now, sadly, most of us are old enough to know that when we sin and we're disciplined for it, or God allows the natural consequences of our sin to be played out, often it will damage the whole family. It is this fully understood reality of three and four generations living together that allowed the phrase "to the third and fourth generation" to become a Hebrew expression that basically meant short term, as opposed to the thousandth, forever. So these verses contrast, that's the key, they contrast that the Lord will show kindness forever to those who continually love and obey him, but will cause consequences for a person's sin to be comparatively short-lived. Now, I have mentioned on a number of occasions a biblical principle that has always been important, but we really haven't been front and center for it in the church or our nation, for that matter, over the last few years. Now, the principle is this. It couldn't be more important for our time. There is only two ways we can know who our invisible God is. Two ways. His name and his characteristics. That's it. We've just been given several characteristics, several attributes of God, and his name has been carefully and firmly associated with those attributes. In fact, it was God himself who pronounced his own name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Again, Yahweh, or I believe it's Jehovah. And who revealed his own characteristics to Moses. Now, obviously, this was not intended as an exhaustive list of all that God is. But really, how much more do we need? Today, there's this ongoing debate within the church as to whether or not the Muslims claim that their God, Allah, is simply the same as God as the God of the Christians and the God of the Jews, Jehovah. I gave a talk on this subject a long time ago. The bottom line was that after I studied the Quran and did some extensive research, I'm convinced Allah cannot possibly be Jehovah. Why? First of all, they don't have the same name. Different names. The Bible puts great importance on names, especially the name of God and the name of Christ. The church has tended to regard names as having a rather unimportant place in our doctrine, and it is coming back to haunt us. You see, Allah is not an Arabic translation of Jehovah. Allah is a nearly 4,000-year-old name for the Arabian moon god. That of itself disqualifies any relationship between Jehovah and Allah. Second of all, Allah and Jehovah certainly do not have the same characteristics. Take every one of the 13 attributes that Jehovah pronounces upon himself here in Exodus, and you will find nearly, if not precisely, the opposite of those characteristics assigned to Allah in the Quran, the Muslim equivalent of the Bible. If they don't have the same name and they don't have the same attributes, it's ludicrous to think they're the same God. See, we need to pay more attention to biblical names, festivals, appointed times, Sabbaths. When we do, we'll understand far more thoroughly who God is, what he's all about, and avoid the consequences of mixing truth with human philosophies and false religions, particularly in our day, when the call is for tolerance, diversity, and peace at all cost. Now let's go back to those two verses again, verses 6 and 7. When we look at some key words in the original Hebrew, we can acquire some deeper understanding. Now I want to substitute some Hebrew words that most of you are now familiar with for their English, for the English translations in verse 6. This is how verse 6 literally reads. Yehovah passed before him and proclaimed, Yehovah, Yehovah, El is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness, and so forth. What I'm trying to demonstrate to you is that for several traditional reasons, The English translations do not actually say the name of God. Rather, when God's name, Yahweh, is actually written in the original, the translators substitute for that the words God or Lord. God and Lord are not names. In our society, we also deal with titles and names as separate things. Mr. or Mrs. is not a name, is it? It's a title. Neither is doctor. Neither is congressman. Somebody's name. Becky's a name. Jerry's a name. King and president are not names. They're just impersonal titles. So when God pronounces his name, it's a very personal thing. So it should not be surprising that in verse 5, when it says that God pronounced his name, that we get this phrase that I just gave to you, whereby he actually uses his formal name, Yahweh, Yahweh, El, is compassionate. Notice also the use of the Hebrew word El here. El is a title for the highest God in any pantheon of gods. El is not a word used only for the God of Israel. El was a title that several of the pagan religions would bestow on whichever of their many gods they thought stood out as above all the other ones. So the concept is God above the other gods. Therefore, in the Bible, we will regularly see the expression, God of gods, Lord of lords, King of kings. This is where it came from. These are all expressions of the concept of El. Now, let me also remind you that while most Bible versions, most translations, will occasionally use Jehovah in English as God's name, that's a reasonably acceptable attempt to pronounce his name in my book, those same versions will employ that name anywhere from 4 or 5, maybe up to 15 or 20 times total in the entire Old Testament. But in the original Hebrew Bible, God's name is written more than 6,000 times. 6,000. We use it no more than 20. Moving on. God pronouncing his name and attributes to Moses and passing before him. Moses now uses this moment to appeal to God to restore this broken relationship with Israel. And he falls on his face before Yahweh. He agrees with his assessment of the situation. He pleads for restoration. There, right there, this is the model for us to approach God when we know we've committed offense against him. This is the first thing we should do. We realize that the sin was committed, and next we confess that sin to God and agree with him that it is sin. Then we ask for restoration. We ask for forgiveness. The fact that a believer's sins have already been forgiven and paid for due to the finished work of Christ does not change how we are to approach God. It doesn't change it a bit. We're still to go before Yahweh every day, confess our sins to him, because I don't know about you, sad to say, I still commit a sin every now and then. Wish I didn't. There's probably one of you out here that never has, but I say that. Tongue in cheek, of course. But unlike Moses, who had to wait for an answer from God, yes, I'll forgive, no, I won't, we are assured that we are forgiven when we confess with contrite hearts. Now try to understand how radical that is. That whole thought is. Right on up to Christ's day and beyond, people were often worried and anxious over whether or not God was going to forgive a sin they had committed. When someone sinned, it required a sacrificial ritual to atone for it. If their sacrifice was not done properly, or it was not accomplished within a certain amount of time, or if the priest that assisted them turned out he wasn't ritually clean, or one of a long list of other possible procedural errors occurred, then the sacrifice might not be accepted, and therefore forgiveness would not be granted. Often the people were not at all sure whether they had been actually forgiven or not. So they carried that dreadful burden upon their shoulders. Believers don't have that problem, thanks to Yeshua. Now we have to note with the greatest sobriety that while God forgives Israel in Exodus 34 and he restores the relationship, he does not yet agree to dwell among them. Nor does he start calling Israel again my people. The moment he's Moses' people. Remember that from last week? Hey, Moses, they're yours. Some of the privilege so freely given to Israel, the intimacy between God and the Hebrews is going to be missing for a little while. This is God's discipline at work. It is a necessary consequence for their sin, even though they are, or soon will be, forgiven. The modern evangelical doctrine among some denominations that Christians can sin without consequence, without discipline, without punishment, is wrong-minded. It has no scriptural backing, Old Testament or New. Forgiveness is forgiveness. Consequence is consequence. One doesn't terminate the other. In verse 10, God reinstates the covenant with Israel that they had broken by means of the apostasy of the golden calf. But Jehovah makes it clear that there's two conditions for Israel if God's promises to Israel within that covenant are going to come about. First, as told in verses 11 through 16, Israel must not mix themselves with the Canaanites. They must not involve themselves in their idolatry. Second of all, there are several God-ordained observances and appointed times, as outlined in verses 17 through 26, that they are always to faithfully keep. And in the same format as the covenant was first given, God says that if you, Israel, will do this, guess what I'll do for you? I will drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites. I'm going to drive them all out of the land, ahead of you. However, says Jehovah, don't you dare make another covenant a peace treaty with any of these people, nor with any other tribe that settled in the land of Canaan, the land that God's giving to Israel. Israel is to make a covenant only with Jehovah. Instead, Israel is to destroy Canaan's sacrificial altar. They're to smash their standing stones. Standing stones were memorials to gods. They were to cut down their tree poles, actually something very akin to totem poles, which were idols. Interestingly, the word used here that is often translated as tree poles or sacred poles, in some version, actually they use the word groves, it's the most literal translation actually, is in Hebrew Asherah, or more literally Asherim, which is the plural form. Asherah is where the name Ashtoreth comes from. This goddess Ashtoreth is also called Astarte. In other cultures, she's called Ishtar. Asherah, Ashtoreth, Astarte, Ishtar are all referring to the same thing, the fertility goddess. Whenever Israel fell into idolatry, it was either the moon god or the fertility goddess that they began to involve in their worship, because this god and goddess were so universally honored. The Hebrews generally did not stop worshiping Yahweh. They just added another god or two into the mix. And isn't it interesting that as much as the modern church just can't resist shaming ancient Israel for their idol worship, that we Christians have adopted the identical name used in the Bible for this pagan fertility goddess that God calls an abomination to use as the name for perhaps our most sacred holy day, Easter. That's right, Easter is simply Anglo-Saxon for Ishtar. Easter was the Anglo-Saxon fertility goddess. See, that's why modern Easter celebrations employs rabbits and eggs. Because a rabbit was usually the symbol for the fertility goddess, and eggs, ovum, were the symbols of fertility. I mean, we need to think long and hard about this. And just how many of our other traditions came about. Traditions that we all hold so dear, or used to anyway, as above reproach. And then we just kind of take an old pagan tradition and add Christ to it. Try to holify it ourselves. Well, in verse 14, with the golden calf incident, so very fresh in the people's mind, God repeats his command to the Hebrews that they are to bow down to no other god. And in verse 15, Yahweh says to Israel that if you do make a covenant, make a treaty, an agreement with any of these other various tribes living in the land of Canaan, you know what it's going to do? It's going to start you down a very slippery slope. Of course, in the books immediately following the Torah, we will see Joshua and others do exactly what God has prohibited here. They will make peace treaties with several of the Canaanite tribes. You see, what Israel did was to disregard God's instructions in favor of what their natural minds thought was a far better course of action. In some instances, they made treaties that allowed the Canaanite kings to continue on in power, provided they paid tribute, taxes, to Israel in return. I mean, who doesn't want free money? Little extra income. Besides, that is how the whole world operated since time immemorial. A conqueror often chose to keep a king in power if it was profitable for him. In other cases, Israel thought they were showing love and mercy by not removing people from the land that God says they were to remove. Certainly God would understand. He would honor their decision and their sincere desire to be nice, to be loving, to be tolerant, right? See, the results of that mindset proved disastrous. And the consequences of that continue on to this day. I don't want to get too preachy, because I mean that. But if ever there was a call to God's church to be uncompromising, this section of Exodus is it. Yahweh is not a God of religious tolerance. Yahweh is not a God of compromise and consensus. Yahweh does not honor our sincerity or our earthly definition of love above his commandments. We're told in verse 14, this is not the first time we've encountered this sort of statement, that he is a jealous God. He will not tolerate the worship of a false god. He just told his people not to mix themselves with pagans, because if it happens, it is inevitable. They will want good relationships with those people, and that will necessarily involve compromise. You can't have it otherwise. And the Lord uses very strong language that is usually diluted by the genteel people who have translated the Bible for us and don't wish to offend the readers. For instance, God calls the act of accepting pagan gods even just into your midst whoring. We all know what that means. Well, the modern world now says that in the perilous times facing humanity, every person on this planet falls into one of two categories: tolerant or hate-filled. If you're not one, you're the other. Now listen to me carefully. This is a satanic principle. It's not a godly principle. God's people are not to be tolerant of false gods, such as Allah, nor are we to declare what God calls evil to be good, such as homosexuality or abortion. We also must not bow down to the wishes and customs of pagans, such as joining with them in their holy days, like Halloween or today, Ramadan, all for the sake of getting along, or frankly, just having a little fun. On the other hand, our response is not to be hatred. It's not to be violence. We do not need to go out of our way to create strife and upheaval. We're to be light. We're not to be a sword. Gentle. We're not supposed to be mean-spirited. But the only light we have is the light of our Savior. And if we tolerate, accept, respect, or join in the ways of his adversary, can we really expect God to be glorified in that? When Israel did this very thing out in the wilderness, what did God do? He removed his presence. He stopped dwelling among them. He even stopped leading them for a while. Do we honestly believe that God's character has changed with the turn of the page from the Old Testament to the New? And now he will tolerate his very own modern day tabernacles where his Holy Spirit resides, us chasing after the pagan ways of this world. See, we're going to have to learn to stand firm and realize that peace with God is not the same thing as peace with the world. In fact, in our age, I'm afraid, they're pretty much opposites. Wish it wasn't so. But it's true. And like Israel had to do in their settling of the promised land, God says you've got to choose one or the other. You can't compromise between the two. And we will continue with chapter 34 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.